Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. I'd like to open up, it is April 4th, and I would like to open up an informational hearing on the Oregon Health Policy Board listening sessions, recommendations for the future of CCOs.
Thank you, Senator Chair. It's my privilege to be here. I'm Brenda Johnson. I serve as an Oregon Health Policy Board member and also as CEO of La Clinica in Southern Oregon. And I'm here today with our chair of the board.
Good afternoon, committee members, Chair Mona Sanderson. My name is Zeke Smith. I'm the chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. And by day, I work for the United Way in the Portland metro area. We're excited to be here to share both a little bit about what we heard when we went out and communicated and heard from folks across Oregon about CCOs, as well as our deliberations and set of recommendations that were related to that information.
So I get to start the presentation today. We've got some slides for you. First, to talk about our process. So it was a delightful opportunity to participate with Zeke and other members of the Oregon Health Authority staff to do a listening tour and to review what Oregonians are thinking about the coordinated care organizations, our transformation to this point, and recommendations for the future. So in July of last year, we responded to the committee request to do an analysis of the CCO performance and recommendations. In August through October, we continued through listening sessions through six communities in the state. And in July through December, we took a lot of information in at the Oregon at the policy board level. And by that, I mean we had the opportunity to listen to information about the health insurance survey data, Oregon health system transformation metrics and their final reports in 2015. We looked at hospital transformation performance project reports. We did a lot of work around primary care payment reform recommendations and heard discussions about that, including interesting conversations about the behavioral health discussion. Or recommendations, to name a few. Also in November of last year, Governor Brown asked us to consider recommendations that were aligned with Oregon's health priorities, and those that are listed on the slide, but she asked in a letter specific to the board that we pay particular focus and attention to issues of health equity, integration of oral and behavioral health with physical health care, listen for things about accountability and transparency in the CCO system, and to talk and listen as we were going throughout the state to think about the level of community engagement. The listening sessions themselves, we held six, as I mentioned, and this slide illustrates where throughout the state. And we also took public comment through a survey process, an online survey process. So in total, we had about 600 respondents to the questions that we put forward. The participants of the listening sessions themselves really composed a pretty broad variety of constituents and stakeholders. We really wanted to thank the community advisory councils, the regional health equity councils, OHA staff support as well for making this opportunity available to us to hear firsthand what was really in the minds and hearts of people in our communities. So the way that we structured our listening sessions, we held small group discussions at tables. Each of the small group conversations then reported out to the large group. We took all of the written summary from that activity and helped compile a summary report. And we really think that I think overall we heard some really interesting things about the CCO evolution. By and large, there was a great deal of support in the communities and from the representation of people who attended the listening sessions about how far CCOs had actually come in their progress in five short years. The following themes here really help illustrate what we, through all this activity and as we compiled the results, what we heard from stakeholders. So the first theme all addresses around the CCO coordination. We broadly asked questions of the constituents about what was working for them, what else they would consider was important for CCOs to do to improve. And what we learned and heard a lot about was that while there had been significant community collaboration and the ability to meet community need and better deliver services in these populations or in these communities, that there was still much work to be done about strengthening systems that helped address social determinants of health. We heard a lot about housing. We heard a lot about food and transportation, especially in rural parts of the state. Secondly, the CCO integration question. We asked broadly, so what parts of the healthcare system feel connected? And what parts did they think that really needed additional improvement, specifically around issues of behavioral health and oral health? What we learned, again, is that while those things have been improved, that there was a strong cry for accelerated improvement in these territories, especially if we were to realize the vision of a truly integrated health system. Third, issues of health equity. We knew that there had been some concerns that were already being addressed, and so when we broadly asked the questions of the constituents, the members themselves, were their needs being understood by others in their community? Were services provided in a culturally appropriate ways? Or were they facing barriers to care? And what we learned is that the healthcare disparities still exist, not surprisingly. That strategies must continue to address cultural competency, social stigmas, and continue to press forward in equitable access, and that we ought to be considering structures to prioritize that. We asked questions specifically about value-based payment. Remember, we had many providers that were also in the listening sessions and CCO representatives. So when we asked the question about did the payment systems themselves really support the kinds of experiences where people would have increased quality in services, whether or not the current alternative payments or value-based payment structures were working in communities or not, and how they might recommend that we spread that activity forward. They suggested that while things were really in progress, that there was still a lot of confusion about what value-based pay or what alternative payment models would really do for us, and that they really suggested that we consider additional coordination on technical assistance in order to receive a clinical or critical mass in payment structures. Noted situations where it was confusing for the delivery system for providers and communities to have one set of rules and regulations on one system that were very different than another. And then last but certainly not least, we heard a theme of CCO governance and structures. We asked the questions about who is at the table in these 16 CCOs across the state who are helping making these really critical decisions in communities. We learned that the CCOs, while have implemented some community feedback mechanisms, that the community's voice overall should be strengthened. That governance structures should definitely reflect local community decisions and prioritizations, and that the public health needs of those communities be transparently communicated, and that CCOs help hold the delivery system accountable for performance. There was a bit of discussion about how CCOs should invest savings in their model in community-needed services, and that we should consider thinking about ways to prioritize and publish the profitability of CCOs in the systems. So the Oregon Health Policy Board then took a lot of what we heard and did a long, long series of evaluation and meetings where we came up with the following kinds of recommendations, both from the listening sessions, and then as we move that into recommendations for the future of coordinated care. So we thought and continue to think that most of the policy recommendations we can address through CCO contracts and administrative rules. We recommend that these changes be included in the next CCO contracting period, which begins in January of 2019, and that while there are a few recommendations, may require some statutory changes, and that the Oregon Health Policy Board will direct the implementation of these recommendations pending the legislature's action. So now I'll turn it to my friend Zeke here as he talks about the recommendations for the future of coordinated care.
Thanks, Brenda. So just to build on that last slide and piece of information a little bit, one, I just want to acknowledge that when we were initially asked to take on this question from the House Healthcare Committee, it was very specifically about looking at what kind of legislative changes might be needed to continue to move the system forward. And as you heard from Brenda, one of the things that as we deliberated became more clear is that we feel that a lot of the kind of changes that are required really are kind of in the purview of the Oregon Health Authority. And so part of what we've done is we've put forward a set of recommendations is really make recommendations both to the Health Authority, where we're providing some direction on changes that we'd like to see or continued progress. But there are a few places in there where it's clear that some legislative action may be either productive or necessary. And we really tried to stay at a high level because we felt like that was the right place for the Health Policy Board to be. The second thing I just want to acknowledge is in the middle of this whole process, as you all know too keenly, we had a lot of change that occurred at a federal level that seemed to immediately put into question kind of what our healthcare system looked like as a whole. And, you know, I think after that initial reaction of shock, there was alignment at the Health Policy Board in just acknowledging that our CCO system, that our coordinated care model really is a productive model, that there has been significant change that's occurred, that we're able to show that we're bending the cost curve from 5.4% to 3.4%, and that it isn't about kind of making a wholesale shift in our state, but it really is about continuing to move forward with the change that we're seeing so that we can meet individuals' needs more effectively and have a more efficient and effective system. So that's not putting a blind eye to what may happen at a federal level, but really just continuing to do what we think is in the spirit of the Oregon way, which is to say we've got some clear ideas about what we want to do to make sure that we're taking care of our population, and we want to keep moving forward with that. So with that, I just wanted to give you a little bit of context, and then I'm going to go through a little bit more specifically the kind of 12 sets of recommendations that we make in our report. And I should just pause and say I'm assuming that you all have had access to both the letter that we sent back to the governor, the set of recommendations, and then our listening session report. So I'm hoping that you have that, but I want to give you a high
level. I certainly do. I don't know if the rest of the committee members do, but could you post
On the first page, under the kind of broad theme of governance, transparency, and accountability, there were really three sets of recommendations. We feel like it's important to continue to highlight the top priority of CCOs. So we're asking that the health authority require CCOs to contract, to clearly state in the contracts that the top priority and motivation is to achieve better health, better care, and lower costs. So just to be really explicit, in effect, about what the mission is of the coordinated care model and of the coordinated care organizations. Secondly, to improve CCO fiscal transparency. As you heard from Brenda, we heard a lot about transparency questions and issues as we went around the state. We're asking the OHA to collect and publish specific financial information related to CCO margins, to medical and non-medical related costs, investments and payments made to partner organizations, and to do that in a standardized format on a quarterly or annual basis. Some of these things the health authority has already been working towards. We just wanted to be really explicit about the set of expectations from the policy board level. And then third, to improve CCO accountability through a more rigorous set of contractual criteria requirements. There were actually a set of criteria that were identified in the initial application process to become a CCO. We'd like to see those carried through the contracting process, which would really focus both on kind of the how you do business, but specifically talking about addressing social determinants of health, enhancing community collaboration, and then ensuring access to primary care, behavioral health, and oral health in an integrated way. Two more recommendations under that broader category of governance, transparency, and accountability. We're looking to clarify the Oregon Health Authority monitoring and oversight function. So in alignment with that notion of being explicit about criteria in the contracting, we want to see further development of management and accountability systems that really function as a way to bring CCOs and the Health Authority together around the core functions that are articulated in the contract, rule, and statute so that there's more clarity about the role of CCOs, but also that happens in a standardized and less burdensome reporting way. We heard a lot about the difficulties and challenges of reporting at each of the different levels in the system, and that there's an intent for the health authority to partner with and provide support to CCOs, particularly as we may see some changes at the federal level that have implications for us locally. And then secondly, or fifth, to enhance community access and input to CCOs. So we felt specifically like there are a few ways, and this is one of the places where we got a little bit more specific, where we think that there's an opportunity to increase that relationship between the community and CCOs. We believe that we should require at least one public CCO governing board meeting to be held annually in public in collaboration with the local community advisory council. We're asking that CCOs work together with the health authority to have a statewide annual community advisory council learning collaborative. We heard a lot from people who are involved in those community advisory councils about the need and the interest to share best practices and to understand what's working in different communities. We want to ensure that there's public transparency about who is on the governing board and on the community advisory council, and that that should be reported on an annual basis. We're asking that at least one community advisory council member who is an Oregon Health Plan member or a parent or guardian of a member, as identified by the community advisory council, serve on the CCO governing board. Currently, there's a requirement that that a community advisory council member is on the governing board. Specifically, we wanted to make sure that this is somebody who has experience as a member or a parent or guardian, and that it's the community advisory council that really identifies that individual. And then lastly, we ask that OHA conduct an analysis of complaints and grievances that happen at different levels in the system, both to make more visible the complaint and grievance process and then to address issues. We heard a lot from both patients and providers about the lack of understanding about how to address particular issues that they might have in the system. And again, it gets at that question and notion of transparency.
Just a question on all of these recommendations, which are, and maybe you don't know this yet, which will require legislative work rather than by rule?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Or by, not there, by rule, but.
Yeah, so this is where I think you all have staff who may be helpful in trying to get specifically at what requires what level of legislative change. And what I mean by that is I think there are some places where there's value in having the legislature affirm a set of expectations and then ask the health authority to enact what needs to happen there, even where there might already be some authority in place. There are other places where specifically we would need some legislative or statutory changes in order to enact change. So, for example, the notion of having a community advisory council member who is identified by the community advisory council and is an OHP member or parent, that would need to happen through legislative change process.
Well, I know that Senator or Representative Greenlee has a bill, and I just got this morning his amendment on his CCO bill, and somehow I would love to have a blend. And hopefully he's, yes, Senator Steiner here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say I've been working some with Representative Greenlee, as you have, on that bill. I think that bill is going a long way towards dealing with the first five recommendations that you have, and maybe some of these later ones, not as far with some of the more pragmatic aspects. And I would hope that perhaps you and I and Representative Greenlee and the health authority could work with Mr. Smith or others to sort of go through and essentially develop a matrix of the recommendations and try to understand which ones they, OHA thinks they can do by rule or contract, which ones need to be fixed statutorily, and whether we need. I have a plan to use one of my priority bills for some of this stuff, but I need a little bit of guidance too. So. A little bit more clarity about teasing those apart, which I know is too much to ask in the committee, but I would agree with you, Madam Chair. We need a little bit more of a matrix, a path.
Okay. Committee Member Steiner Hayward, Chair Monis Anderson, thanks for the comment. So we have actually looked at the 2122 bill that is on the House side and done some crosswalking of our specific recommendations with what's in that bill. I think generally speaking, the issues that 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 bill is intending to address are very similar to the themes and the issues that we've identified. When you get to the specifics, there are some differences. And we do have some sense of how you could begin to make that crosswalk and figure out what specifically needs to be addressed through the legislative process and where the health authority is in a position to make some of those changes.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Yep.
Proceed.
Great. So I'm going to move on to our recommendations 6 through 8, all of which fit under the broader heading of health equity and social determinants of health. We're recommending that we really are strengthening accountability and transparency around health equity. This includes intentional transparency around data and the use of data, member experience, measuring, reporting outcomes for folks of color, children, and specific populations. We are actually in the process of establishing a health equity subcommittee, which will report to the Health Policy Board and is charged with accelerating the development of policies related to health equity. This is one of those places where there isn't much mention of health equity in the current 21-22, maybe some opportunity to be explicit and intentional about impacts there. Seventh, focus on social determinants of health. We're asking that CCOs work directly with the OHA Office of Equity and Inclusion, really to ensure that social determinants of health, including housing, education, criminal justice, employment opportunities, neighborhood environment, and transportation, are addressed through community partnerships, collaborative community health assessments, community health improvement plans, and transformation plans. Right now, in different CCOs, you see different aspects of this being addressed in different places. There's not a lot of alignment there, and we feel like there's an important opportunity to create some alignment, both across those different plans so that they're aligned with each other, and with a specific intention around engaging other systems in supporting the work that needs to happen to make sure that folks' health is adequately taken care of.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Smith, some of the things you're talking about in this look a little like metrics, but on the other hand are a little bit tougher to measure because they're on a population, I mean, they're sort of on a communal level as opposed to something you can measure on a bunch of individuals and therefore give you a population measure. And I'm wondering about how you all are thinking about these recommendations in collaboration with the Task Force on Metrics and Scoring that was set up by Senate Bill 440 and is just beginning its work now to establish unified metrics both for CCOs and for commercial insurance so that all populations can benefit from unified metrics and we can make it easier for insurers and providers. So how do you see these recommendations fitting in with other kinds of metrics that we're already working on? I'm not disagreeing with you, mind you. I just want to understand this a little better.
Thank you, Senator Steiner Hayward, Chair Monis Anderson. It's a timely question. We actually raced over here from our Health Policy Board meeting this morning, and one of the things that we did was to approve a charter for the new metrics committee that the governor has appointed specifically to address the Senate Bill 440 questions that you raised. It's a good question. I think that two things. One, we in the charter and then in a letter that we'll be sending to that committee, the Health Policy Board has asked the committee to be intentional about thinking about efficiency across different systems and not overly cumbersome in terms of putting new metrics in place. It'd be easy to go through a list like this and create a whole set of new metrics that don't necessarily move us forward. So I think we're really intentional about that notion of being efficient. As we think about these particular recommendations, I think they really have a lot to do with kind of what it is that CCOs do within local communities to move on population-level health change, as well as specific health issues for patients and then cost. So I think there is a question about, like, what's the right metric as we think about social determinants of health, particularly if it's in an area that is not, let's say that it's housing, where actually the CCOs don't have direct authority over housing. They're going to have to work with another partner in order to impact and influence and affect housing for the population. As we think about these recommendations, it's really about how we encourage a more uniform approach across the state to addressing some of these issues and build off of some of the local best practices that we're seeing. So in different communities, we're seeing CCOs that are actually taking a pretty proactive approach to addressing some of these issues. And I think that's one of the places where we'll also pull through and pull up some of the specific metrics that are helping to organize those communities effectively.
Quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. Thank you. More of a comment than a question at this point. I think this also points out the need that we have to do better budget alignment. As the chair of the Senate co-chair of the Human Services Subcommittee, which is obviously very concerned with the OHA budget, I'm also concerned with the DHS budget, which has a role to play in this. I'm having conversations with Senator Monroe and Representative Smith Warner about the education budget and how that overlaps with Senator Johnson and Representative Gomberg about the Department of Housing and Community Services, with Senator Winters and Representative Stark about criminal justice. And I think one of the challenges that we face is figuring out where these areas of overlap in budgets exist and how do we leverage budgets so that we get the most bang for the taxpayer's dollar and use them in ways that may not be traditional. So I think it's great that you're pointing out these issues because there are such strong areas of overlap in so many ways. So thank you very much for that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator Steiner Hayward, Chair Monis Anderson. I think the other thing that we saw as we looked in local communities was just, as I was saying earlier, that there really are some really kind of shining examples where CCOs and communities have come together around specific issues. And I think part of the challenge for you all as a legislature and for us to consider is when and where and how do we provide kind of statewide guidance to support that work and support it more universally. And when and where and how do we really take advantage of the fact that we've got 16 different CCOs and we've got a whole bunch of different communities that are working through these issues at a local level. And so I appreciate that notion of more intentionality around budgets across different systems and hope that part of what you'll see in here is that we're really reinforcing the idea that local communities are in a good position to identify where their opportunities are there. Eighth recommendation, still under the larger title of Health Equity and Social Determinants of Health, which is to bolster the workforce diversity across the state. We're really interested in using state incentive pools and strategies as identified by our Healthcare Workforce Committee to improve workforce training, diversity, and retention, specifically within underserved and rural communities. And want to identify and remove barriers related to payment, system structure, and qualifications for use of traditional health worker services within CCO contracting and administrative rules. I will call this out just to say that in each of the different communities that we were in, there were specific examples that were raised about how traditional health workers, not always that term, but people that fit into that category, were a critical part of the connectivity in the local system, whether that was peer specialists who were working with folks who had issues with substance abuse, or whether that was promotoras who were working with specific Latina communities around how they engage in the system. It came up time and again across the state, and we really want to see that we can, we want to figure out how to bolster that element of the system so that we can be most effectively meeting the needs of populations who right now we have a hard time meeting their needs. Moving on. So under the broader category of system integration and accelerating that system integration, we want to continue to focus on oral and behavioral health integration with our physical health system and are intentionally thinking about how to mandate that. We want to ensure that CCOs have flexibility in how they contract effectively with oral health providers. We want to strengthen the CCO contract regarding oral health integration as a mandate and ensure that oral health is included in CCO transformation plans. So glad to see that that's moving. We want to ensure that oral health providers have similar protections to other providers in CCO and DCO subcontracts that came up as an issue in some of the communities. In the behavioral health space, we want to ensure a delivery system that contains no wrong door, and we really want to strengthen the CCO criteria around requiring a seamless consumer-facing integration of behavioral health. A lot of work to do on that front. And then to your question earlier, Senator Montes Anderson, we want to be able to identify performance metrics that are consistent with the Oregon Performance Plan and reflected in the three-year agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. And we're looking to this new metrics committee and then the metrics and scoring subcommittee to identify ways to incentivize CCOs to improve oral health integration, behavioral health, and behavioral health integration. A lot up underneath that particular recommendation. And then we want to increase primary care spending and accelerate payment reform. So we want to align primary care payment practices with the Federal Comprehensive Primary Care Plus, which we're part of as per the recommendation from Senate Bill 231 the last time around, the Primary Care Payment Reform Collaborative. And we want to see greater transparency regarding primary care spending, utilization, and primary care value-based payments. There's a lot of reference in House Bill 2122 as it currently is written around alternative payment methodologies. We think that's important. We see, but we don't want to lose the larger focus on primary care as a critical space to be paying attention to. So last two.
Can I just ask one question? Going back to the previous slide, did you, in the course of the listening sessions, did you get any sense from people are on the behavioral side about how they perceived the work between the counties and which are now currently have some level of responsibility for behavioral health and the CCOs and how to make that work? Because I think, honestly, that's one of the thorniest problems we face in revamping delivery of these services to Oregonians. So do you guys have any thoughts about that? I'm not trying to put you on the spot or get you in trouble with the counties. But I'm thinking about that and wrestling with it a lot, and I'm trying to figure it out.
Zeke tapped me on the elbow for that one. So Senator Steiner.
Sorry, Ms. Johnson.
No concern at all. I think that what we heard was that the issue is very, very real and very tender in communities, and that each community has opinions about how they want to see a really high-quality delivery system for behavioral health in their own community. What was unclear, at least to me, and I'd be, is that there's no one right path. You know, in some communities, it appeared that the delivery system and the relationships with counties were really strong and vibrant, and in others, not so much. And so what I think is there's a possibility for drawing people to conclusions where they're looking at the best interest of the members in the communities, and I think in that way they'll find the places where there's common agreement.
Okay.
And then follow up on your primary care spending. I know we have a bill that prohibits CCOs from spending less than 14.4% of their global budget on primary care and community health. And I'm just curious, when we start having bills like this, it seems like, that there might be better coordination with what the Health Policy Board is doing, even though this isn't really against any of your core missions. So I know you can't weigh in on bills, but
and just as an aside, there's some significant amendments to that bill coming your way.
So you know, that's why I love having your listening sessions, and I have always said from the beginning, if people would start paying attention to this, and let's keep this as a blueprint, because I just don't want to make it too complicated for OHA, for the CCOs, for the Health Policy Board, and I truly do believe we need to have a lot of coordination and you setting the roadmap. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Montes Anderson. It's heartening to hear your appreciation for the listening session report. So we have a set of recommendations that are fairly specific, but still at a high level. But there's such rich information in those in that report, and I agree. I think there's an opportunity to really use that as a roadmap, or at least as a guide, as we all are deliberating about what kinds of changes we need in the system. I think that the Health Policy Board was actually excited to see a number of different bills that addressed or are attempting to address some of the issues that we've raised. The specifics, is 14.4% the right level? you all get to wrestle with that question. And I'm sure there are other folks who have more specific responses to that. But in general, the idea of putting a stronger focus on primary care as a critical part of the system and ensuring that CCOs are in a position to really continue to support that feels like it's really important and is in alignment with our recommendations.
Great.
So lastly, two recommendations around cost, which we know is a critical issue. One of those is specifically about trying to wrestle with and address the issue of high-cost prescription, also known as budget-busting drug prices. And there are a set of different strategies that we feel are important to consider in some package as we work towards addressing this. And this is one of those places where I think the devil is in the detail around which of these would require legislative action, which of them can we ask the health authority to move rapidly on. But I would just want to call out those specific strategies. Increasing price transparency to improve public visibility and accountability. Considering creating a public utility model to oversee in-state drug prices. Looking at the creation of a single common and standardized preferred drug list across the CCOs and the Medicaid fee-for-service population, considering bulk purchase and distribution of high-priced, broadly indicated drugs that protect drugs that protect public health, exploring state ability to operate as a pharmacy benefit manager to broaden purchasing and negotiating power, and increased coordination with Washington State through the Northwest Prescription Drug Purchasing Consortium to increase the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan purchasing power. And lastly, we're asking the health authority and the CCOs to work together on education for patients and providers regarding misleading marketing of prescription drugs. So we think that those coordinated fashion present an opportunity for us to really address some of the larger high-cost issues, recognizing that at the end of the day, that's really a federal problem, but we have to have some sort of local state solutions to try to address the impact that that has on our budgets. Last recommendation, increasing the use of values-based payments. So we're asking that the health authority collaborate with and work with CCOs to expand values-based payment arrangements with hospitals and specialty providers and ensure incentives for quality and efficiency, to create clearer requirements and definitions for values-based payment, ensuring that incentives are actually reaching the providers that are treating the patients, and requiring a percentage along the lines of the bill that was mentioned of CCO spending to be values-based and reported, and setting targets for values-based payment adoption and reviewing the outcomes and the operationalization of that system. Last slide. We voted on these recommendations in January. As you have in front of you and on OLIS, there is a report around with much more detail about the listening sessions. And then we have a number of materials from our meetings. As Brenda said, we deliberated on this in a number of different meetings. The last point that I would want to make is just, again, to reinforce the idea that ultimately, we both started with an assumption, and it was affirmed through the process, that our coordinated care model is moving in the right direction, that we're better able to serve Oregonians' needs, particularly those in need, today than we were 5 years ago, and that our responsibility as a system is to continue to make improvements to that system so that we can continue to better meet the needs of those of all Oregonians. And we're more than happy and excited to engage with you all at a committee level or individually around how to do that crosswalk in terms of thinking about these recommendations in the legislative context, and look forward to that. Questions?
Thank you. Questions?
Like we need a big meeting.
I really appreciate this. I mean, we're going to start hearing some CCO bills, and I wanted the committee to make sure that they knew about the Health Policy Board, about what you've already done, extensive work with the CCOs and the report that you have produced. So thank you so very much. With that, no further questions, and I'm going to close the informational hearing on Oregon, the Health Policy Board listening session, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 917. We have Paul Tredoll and Julie, is it Cornack?
Yes. Hey.
Thank you, Chair Monasanderson and members of the committee. My name is Paul Tredoll. I'm a resident of Northwest Portland and Senate District 18, and I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 917 as a private citizen and also as a volunteer consumer advocate that has over the years worked with well over 100 consumers in terms of coverage issues involving primarily commercial insurance as well as Medicaid, and including a couple of dozen that have gone through the external medical review process with commercial insurance. Senate Bill 917 basically implements a federal regulation that permits external medical review as an appeal process for Medicaid. External medical review is a process that we already have in Oregon for commercial insurance. It lets a consumer appeal a denial of coverage that's based on medical judgment, like whether or not something is medically necessary, to a medical doctor appointed by the state of Oregon that has specific expertise in the condition and the treatment in question. We have found this to be very efficient, very fair, effective, and inexpensive as a process of resolving these disputes with commercial insurance. We came into this issue with Medicaid really because of some issues that came up last summer involving coverage of treatment for autism in Medicaid. There was a bit of a rocky transition in July when the autism program was transitioned from the OHA directly to the CCOs, and a lot of those issues have been worked out. We've rewritten the administrative rules a couple of times. We've had some good discussions with Director Saxton and CMS and the CCOs that I think have really cleared up a lot of those issues. But in the process of that, we gained some more experience with the appeals process in available to consumers in Medicaid and realized that there were some gaps that really could be closed. Currently, if you have OHP and the CCO denies coverage, you do an internal appeal. That makes sense. But then your only appeal beyond that is to what's called a fair hearing, where you basically go to an administrative law judge who has really no medical credentials of any kind to basically hear out the position from the CCO, the position from the consumer, and make a legal-based decision on coverage. And that's fine and reasonable if you're talking about an interpretation of law or the contract and what's supposed to be covered. It doesn't really make so much sense if you're talking about medical judgment. I'll give an example. Currently an OHP, it used to be an OHP that there were specific visit limits on speech therapy, as an example. They'd say, okay, you get no more than, say, 20 visits per year, whether you need, no matter how many you need. Those limits are gone because they violated a couple of different federal statutes. So currently, there are no limits except for what's medically necessary. That's a judgment call. There's no way an administrative law judge is really in a position to make a decision about who's right there. And so what this process would do, if there's a difference of opinion over what's medically necessary, the consumer or the consumer's provider could request external review where the government would appoint an outside doctor to basically review this and make a decision. So we think that's a much better kind of decision. What we have structured, so we had a number of discussions before developing this bill. We discussed it with Director Saxton. We discussed it with Elliot Fishman at CMS. And we had some discussions with the Division of Financial Regulation back in December about it. The actual language we had was written by Jeanette Holman, who's a retired senior policy analyst within the Insurance Division. And it basically links into the existing statutes that are already there for commercial insurance. It would implement a federal regulation that permits it and then encourages the health authority to have an interagency agreement with DCBS to administer it using essentially the same procedures they already have. So we think it's pretty straightforward. It should increase the service load and the volume that DCBS processes, but there shouldn't be a significant change in processes, and it should be, I think, a really saving some effort in terms of fair hearing trials that we currently have. So I'm going to turn it over to Julie to talk a little bit about her experience nationally with this kind of process. Then I'm happy to take your questions.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Chair Hollis Anderson and committee members. I work with the Center for Autism and Related Disorders.
You state your name for the record.
My name is Julie Cornack, and I work with the Center for Autism and Related Disorders. We're the largest provider of autism treatment services, and we're in 25 states right now, including 6 locations in Oregon. And we've absolutely encountered some confusion. Our families have encountered confusion at the appeals process on the Medicaid side. Your commercial side works really efficiently. And on the Medicaid side, what we've noticed, especially when we're working with families where their English isn't their native language, they're very intimidated by the thought of a fair hearing. That whole thing just, seems like they're going to court, and they shy away from it. So they only really take advantage of that internal appeal process, which stays in place with this legislation. And they don't have that external review that the commercial insured has. And so we would really like to see those two processes be the same for across the population so that we have our Medicaid folks getting access to the same appeals process as the commercially insured. We think it's really effective. As Paul was saying, that way you have experts in their field contracted through the independent review organization that is chosen by one of the state agencies. I'm sure Paul actually probably knows which one. And that way you have this independent person who doesn't have any skin in the game, who's just hired to review it. In autism treatment especially, there's a lot of nuances about how many hours of treatment a child should get per week. And you can see where there would be an expert, a difference of opinion in the internal review process versus what the provider's thinking and what the family wants because of what they've read. And then to have that outside expert come in and be this independent review that's accessible for the families and provide a final decision is going to make the process work better. It makes families less litigious because they feel they've been heard. And it, in our experience, we get a pretty fair result.
Questions?
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. BJ Kavanaugh and John Mullen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is BJ Kavanaugh, and I serve as Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are a public advocacy group that represents people living with chronic health conditions in Oregon. I'd like today to speak in our support of the bill for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that there has been a standard of inconsistency with some members, OHP members, who receive services directly from the state, fee-for-service, and some who are CCO members. What we've seen is that the lack of an external review process has allowed some, let me preface this, some CCOs to get away with things that they would not otherwise be able to get away with regard to treatment access for patients. It's often the patients don't understand, who are CCO members, that they have these other options for appeal under the Oregon Health Authority. And many are come to organizations like my own and like Mr. Mullins seeking recourse of a way that they are able to get treatment for a condition that they need. Many of these inconsistencies are arbitrary. They're put in place by, frankly, a lack of the health authority to be able to hold the CCOs accountable to the rule of law. And I understand that there's progress in moving towards that situation, but we're not there yet. Senator Steiner Hayward is aware of a situation that we spoke to her about, a patient who was denied access to treatments for viral hepatitis C because of the arbitrary conditions that were put in place by his CCO. And I won't speak for the senator. I will say that she seemed surprised that none of the reasons the CCO provided were based on clinical medicine or any kind of evidence. In particular, this was about a patient who didn't have stable housing and that the patient abstained from cigarette smoking for more than the year. No one wants to promote cigarette smoking, but its effectiveness on this procedure had nothing to do with the other. So we support this. We support the ability for patients to understand and become better citizens and administrators of their own health by having the external accountability in place for CCOs and that we all play by the same rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center has supported the transformation efforts in the state of Oregon, particularly the value-based, person-centered approach and the integration of services. Having said that, there are times when in our network we have people coming forward that have concerns about underutilization, denial of service, those kinds of issues. We have no particular position on this bill, but I really appreciated the discussion, Madam Chair, as you started us off, and Senator Steiner Hayward adding to this, is that we're watching the bill on the House side, House Bill 2122, and I think it does make sense to take a look at what kinds of improvements we want to make to CCOs this time around, looking at what things can be done administratively, what kinds of things will require statutory change. I would just say that if there's going to be discussion on these CCO bills, it's not enough to have the CCOs and OHA and perhaps even legislative involvement, but we would strongly encourage some consumer advocacy involvement in this discussion as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 917 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 233.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 233, the bill codifies a number of definitions in Oregon statutes, requires the Oregon Health Authority to publicly release financial and healthcare utilization data used to calculate global budgets for coordinated care organizations. It would require OHA to use uniform standards when reporting data publicly, but also require the Oregon Health Authority to use specified criteria when establishing a global budget. There is a dash 2 amendment posted on OLIS, and testimony is also available on OLIS.
Thank you. My name is Art Suhorzewski, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Family Care Health. Thank you so much for having this hearing today and for the opportunity to testify. I will speak specifically to the Dash 2 amendments since they are replacing the text of the bill. This legislation is about requiring actuarial soundness for each CCO and requiring transparency in the rate-setting process. SB 233 would also require that OHA conform to the legislative intent for global budgets for CCOs in current law. This legislation is critical in helping us understand OHA's rate development process today and is in line with the CMS principles regarding actual soundness. The following comments from CMS on actual soundness in their 2016 Medicaid rule encapsulates why we believe the legislation is necessary and in keeping with current standards. Quote, capitation rates should be sufficient and appropriate for the anticipated service utilization of the populations and services covered under the contract and provide appropriate compensation to the managed care plans for reasonable non-benefit costs. Actual rate certification underlying the capitation rates should provide sufficient detail, documentation and transparency of the rate setting components set forth in this regulation to enable another actuary to assess the reasonableness of the methodology and the assumptions supporting the development of the final capitation rate. And I can provide that citation to the committee in writing. In the Dash 2 amendment, we are including the CMS definition for actuarial soundness from 42 CFR 438.4, which states, quote, actuarially sound capitation rates are projected to provide for all reasonable, appropriate, and attainable costs that are required under the terms of the contract, end quote. This will conform the rate development process to the CMS standard and guide OHA's rate development for 2018 and beyond. As you know, Family Care has been requesting the regional-based data from OHA to help our independent actuary determine whether our 2017 rates are actuarially sound. Family Care believes that our 2017 rates are fundamentally flawed because of policy decisions and clawbacks used to develop these rates. One of these clawbacks is a $34 million arbitrary reduction in our primary care payments from our base data used to develop our 2017 rates. The explanation given to us by OHA was that we pay our primary care providers too much. This violates the global budget provisions in state law and contradicts the state's own research showing that investment in primary care leads to overall savings in the healthcare system. Our actuary, Milliman, says that our 2017 rates will result in a loss of approximately $50 million for the company in 2017, as shown in the following exhibit. Family Care continues to be the lowest paid coordinated care organization in the state. We have a reduction of rates from 2014 of 15.6%, and that comparison is equal across the board, across the largest CCOs, across the state, and across our counterpart in the Portland area. Conversely, as the slide shows, the state CCOs overall saw an increase of 4.3% in their capitation rates during that same period. Our rates thus far in 2015 and 2016 have resulted in a $56 million reduction to our reserves. Section 3 of the bill really gets down to the important aspect of transparency in the rate-setting process. It would require a disclosure of aggregated or average base data used to develop rates for all coordinated care organizations, not individual contractual relationships between CCOs and providers. Prior to 2012, this data was made publicly available in a comprehensive data book, which any managed care organization could use as a comparison tool. This base data is used as a starting point by an actuary in the development of capitation rates for a specific population or category of service. In contrast to OHA, CMS publicly discloses this aggregated base data by individual plan for the Medicare Advantage program. The exhibit on the screen shows the level of data that CMS makes available for each individual plan. There's quite a lot of detail there. The next exhibit shows what OHA makes publicly available for OHP. The majority of the information, as you can see, is completely blacked out and useless to any actuary working to validate actuarial soundness. The bottom line is that prior to 2012, the state reported the Medicaid data used to develop rates, and now it does not. In the case of Medicare Advantage, the data is online and accessible to any actuary who wants to review it. Section 4 of the Dash 2 amendments would return the rate development process to the way it was done for 20 years when CCOs had a truly global budget that allowed for flexibility and innovation. This language would prevent the kind of arbitrary line-by-line adjustments and clawbacks used by OHA that violate the global budget provisions in state law. Section 4 would also restore the single statewide risk score methodology, the most accurate and rational approach to rate development for the Oregon Health Plan. Up until 2015, this methodology was used reliably by the state for rate setting and would allow for modifications to rates based on demographics of each CCO. OHA's switch to regional rate setting has led to wide, unexplained discrepancies in rates across the state. Section 4 would also address uniformity in OHA's reporting of CCO data and timeliness in receiving quality metrics from the state. The very last provision in this section would allow any coordinated care organization to appeal their rate determinations with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. No process for rate challenge has existed prior to this language that we're proposing. Had it been in place in 2015 and 2016, Family Care would never have needed to file a lawsuit to challenge our rates. Section 5 of the bill, which is the last section, would establish this independent process at DCBS. We believe that this agency is uniquely qualified for this function as they have expertise in this regard in the commercial market. We met with DCBS on this provision earlier in the year and addressed the only concern that they voiced at the time, which is the fiscal aspect of the appeal. And we've included a provision at the very end that would allow the agency to charge a fee for the appeal up to the cost. Before concluding, we would like to address and clarify the recent CMS decision to approve Oregon's Medicaid rates for 2017. This was not a certification of the rates for actuarial soundness, which is what this bill would address along with the transparency in the rate development process. When reviewing the rates for any given year, CMS does not certify the rates as actuarially sound, but merely approves the state's contract for the year that includes rate payment exhibits. We urge the committee to support this very important legislation. Thank you again for having this hearing.
Are you done for this bill, or are you going to keep going?
Bill. Chair Montes-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Bill Murray. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Family Care. I wanted to underscore a couple points that Art made about the bill. Art talked about this bill's impact on Family Care. We believe this bill is a positive bill for all CCOs and that it improves transparency, accuracy, timeliness for all CCOs across the process. If I go back to this slide here, this slide shows significant variability across CCOs in the rates that they are being paid. This bill seeks to have us be able to understand what and how that variability resulted. There is more variability between CCOs and between eligibility groups, which are supposed to be like people, now in 2017 than there was in 2014. So variability has increased, as well as the volatility. And if you think about the global budget, the idea of the global budget was predictable increases over time at a rate that's sustainable. The current process allows this variability and uncertainty to creep in, which is exactly the opposite of what the global budget sought to do in order for CCOs to make long-term investments in the community and the health of the members that they serve. Additionally, the current rates are not certified as being actuarially sound for each individual CCO, okay? What the current actuary does for OHA is actually only certify that the regional average rates are actuarially sound. So these rates that appear here, they have not been certified for each CCO. There is nothing preventing OHA from doing that. CMS says that is fine. It used to be done, but it's just not done anymore. So if we're trying to understand and get to rates that are appropriate rates for each CCO, they should be certified as being actuarially sound for each CCO. That's what our bill asks to make a requirement, that each CCO's rates are certified individually for each category of eligible as being actuarially sound. This bill would then benefit every CCO from that aspect. The review process is one that allows DCBS, a qualified entity, to be able to look and provide insight to the CCO about that rate setting process. If the CCO was wrong and challenged that, the CCO would pay for the cost of that. This whole point of having rates that are sustainable and predictable is really at the core of this for CCOs to survive and make the type of investments and the long-term commitments that you heard elicited from the Oregon Health Policy Board's suggestions. You need to know that you're going to be around and have the ability to be around to make those investments. So having stability in the rate setting process is very critical. The other point about transparency of data, I want to clarify and make sure you're absolutely clear that this bill asks only for regional average rates and regional average utilization. It does not require disclosure of any individual provider information at the provider contracting level. It only asks for disclosure of those averages, which are critical, once again, to improving the program. When we had the data book previously, CCOs, including the CCO I was involved in, we would scour that data book, compare our data to data across the region, which was the statewide region at that point in time, and understand where we were higher or lower on utilization, where we were higher or lower on costs, and we sought to improve in those areas that had a variance in. We would call other CCOs. We would communicate with other CCOs about that. If you go back to the original House Bill 3650, there's a provision in that bill that talks about allowing CCOs to share that information and not be in violation of antitrust laws. So the fact that information sharing of this type of financial information at a higher level, it was envisioned as being one of the criteria for improving health and seeking to transform healthcare going forward. So our belief is that this bill greatly benefits all CCOs. It requires transparency on behalf of the CCO, transparency across on behalf of the agency, and we believe it will benefit all organizations going forward. Thank you.
Two questions, or maybe probably one question. I don't know if this actually affects why you were rated or why your reimbursement payment rates turned out the way they were. But one is you do an excellent job with behavioral health. In fact, from what I've been told, you are like number one in the services that you give for behavioral health. You made that decision. You made a business decision to pay your primary care providers more than others. If you didn't do as much in behavioral health, or if you didn't pay your providers as much more than other CCOs, would that have affected your payment rates?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, the answer to that is I don't know, because we do not have the data and how OHA used that data in the process. From our own internal review, and the reason we increased those rates for behavioral health providers, primary care providers, and for consultative visits, face-to-face time for specialists with our members, is that we believe that that interaction with our members actually lowers other costs. And we have actually seen that happen. And I'd refer you even to OHA's own study about patient-centered primary care homes and the return on investment for increasing dollars spent on primary care are more than offset by reductions in other areas. So in and of itself, we do not think that that is the reason we are the lowest. We do not know, because we have not been given that data.
Thank you. Other? All right. With that, I will, and stay up there, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 233 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 234.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 234, the bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to renew its contract with the Coordinated Care Organization if certain conditions are met. There are no amendments.
Hello.
Wait.
Thank you. Thank you again. Speaking in support of the Senate Bill 234. This legislation would establish certainty and predictability for CCOs as our state's health care transformation continues, as long as they fulfill their obligations.
Now, wait, are we talking about an amendment?
There's no amendment.
No amendment.
No
okay.
amendment.
Mm-hmm. So, all right.
Yes.
Thank you.
As long as CCOs fulfill their obligations under the terms of their contract with the state, this legislation would allow those CCOs to continue to serve their communities in the next five-year contract. CCOs have been very successful over the last 4 years in integrating care, developing serve their communities' needs, and building partnerships with community organizations that serve our most vulnerable citizens. This has required significant investment on the part of the CCOs in developing new expertise, provider networks, and programs to serve members under the CCO model. As a CCO, Family Care launched its Provider Patient Oriented Resource Teams, or PORTs, an innovation we pioneered to fully integrate our members' customer service experience. This means that our members and providers receive personalized service with just one phone call to their PORT team for any question or concern they have. This level of integration required considerable investment in technology and staff. With the flexibility afforded to CCOs under our state's global budget statutes, Family Care is launching a program to expand access to doulas for pregnant women in minority communities, an intensive care and social support program for foster children, and a health literacy and access initiative for members 15 to 25 years of age. These are just three examples of the many initiatives throughout Oregon that coordinated care organizations are making every day in their communities. This legislation will ensure that these programs continue to improve the health of our communities. Because we recognize that healthcare does not just begin and end in a doctor's office, CCOs have been financially committed to their communities since our inception. Family Care has invested over $12.4 million through grants, sponsorships, and other contributions just since 2015. Many of these investments go to support behavioral health services and to address community determinants of health in the Portland metro area. According to the Oregon Health Authority, coordinated care organizations have led the way in reducing emergency department utilization by nearly 50% and hospital readmissions by one-third. With the CCO model in place, we have saved $1.4 billion to federal and state Medicaid budgets since 2012 and helped increase the number of insured to nearly 95%. It is important to note that all of our accomplishments and investments in healthcare innovation over the last 5 years were achieved at below Oregon's 3.4% inflation cap for Medicaid. SB 234 does not allow CCOs to rest on their past accomplishments to continue. It requires them to maintain and improve their initiatives and achievements of quality metrics going forward. Oregon has built a solid foundation in caring for our Medicaid population. We should build on that foundation. We urge the committee to support this legislation to ensure continuity of care for our members and the preservation of the critical investments made thus far. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson. Bill Murray again. SB 234 is a bill I love for its simplicity. This bill is about recognizing the accomplishments that the CCOs have made to date. It is certainly about creating additional accountabilities going forward, and it's about impartiality in deciding who gets to contract or be offered a contract going forward. Obviously, you've heard lots of testimony from today, other sessions, including the Oregon Health Policy Board, where CCO accomplishments over this last five-year period have been pretty remarkable if you look at what's happened with Oregon's experience compared to a national standard. Yes, we have lots more to do, but what we've done should be recognized. This bill says that we are going to recognize what the CCOs have accomplished to date. This bill is also about accountability going forward. Some have commented that this bill is an evergreen bill, that it's an evergreen contract. It's not an evergreen contract when every year we have a new set of requirements that are tougher, harder, higher, make us jump, run faster. So it's not evergreen in that standpoint. It's not the case under the prior five-year contract, nor would it be the case going forward. there are significant enhancements every year. Our current contract in and of itself is 272 pages long. It is not something that you can actually do in your sleep. It takes active engagement and involvement by all CCOs across the state.
Say that again. Your contract with OHA is 272
pages long of contractual requirements.
Okay.
If that wasn't enough, there are no less than 48 contractually required deliverables and reports due under our 2017 contract. These are in addition to what's required by the CCO quality incentive metrics. Each CCO is required to submit a number of plans and projects, which each require the CCO to establish benchmarks and improvement targets and make progress towards those improvement targets. If a CCO doesn't do that, they are non-compliant with their contract. It is not an evergreen contract. So to provide a little bit of information on those, each year a CCO has to submit an annual quality performance assessment and improvement plan. It has to look back on what it did and actually then use that information to say how it's going to improve in the future and submit that to OHA for approval. Each CCO has, in addition to that, performance improvement projects. These are individual projects that a CCO adopts with OHA's approval, as well as there being statewide performance improvement projects like the most recent opioid reduction effort. Each CCO has a transformation plan that sets out specific requirements and benchmarks and dates. The elements, there's eight specific elements in that transformation plan. Many of those, once again, echo actually the areas that you heard talked about from the Oregon Health Policy Board. Those eight areas are integration of care, patient-centered primary care homes, alternative payment methodologies, community health assessment and community health improvement plans, electronic health records and health information exchange, communications, outreach, and member engagement, meeting the culturally diverse needs of our members, and eliminating racial, ethnic, and linguistic disparities. Each one of those elements has identified benchmarks and objectives that each CCO is attempting to meet over a period of time, and those get reviewed and evaluated and updated. Each CCO has a technology plan. Each CCO, in addition to its part in the transformation plan, has other requirements with regards to its community health assessment and community health improvement plan. I think you get the message that there is a lot that we're required to do, and that benchmark is raised every single year. And there is nothing in this legislation that halts that at all. Each year, OHA, in conjunction with the CCOs, works on the contract and what the requirements are going to be under that contract. And actually, it's a partnership with OHA through which that happens. But OHA can send us whatever contract they believe they want to have and whatever requirements. They have control in that, and there's nothing in this bill that stops that control. What we want is a good exchange of information on that, and we want to challenge us to continue to improve like we have done in the past. Nothing in this bill stops that forward progress. Finally, this bill is about impartiality. The bill says that if a CCO has done all the things it was supposed to do, as listed in the contract that had those increasing benchmarks every year, that OHA is supposed to offer each CCO, each and every CCO that met those criteria and requirements, an opportunity to contract going forward. It's what I think we want in Oregon. We've done a great job, and I would think we'd want to have that continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Comments? Questions? All right.
Thank you.
And I do want to state, I forgot to say this on Senate Bill 233, but there is testimony on OLIS on both of those bills. I have not yet read them, whether they are for or against, but I did want to state that for the record. Okay. If there's no, okay, thank you. And Bruce Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members Beyer, Steiner Hayward, and Knopp, thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm Bruce Thompson. I'm a retired family physician. I have also served as the Benton County Health Officer for the past 19 years. Today I am here representing the Legislative Committee for Health Care for All Oregon. And we are here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 234. Health Care for All Oregon has affiliates numbering over 120 member organizations, and this includes 20,000 advocates that agree with our mission. And our mission is to work for an equitable, affordable, high-quality, publicly funded universal health care system serving everyone in Oregon. We are in favor of everything that CCOs can do to move us toward that goal. I now understand who supports who the sponsors were of this bill, because when I looked in OLIS, we were not able to find who the sponsors were. In fact, we were not able to really figure out what the problems that the bill was trying to address. I guess we had a little perspective on that here with the previous conversation. But from our perspective, Senate Bill 234 appears as if it essentially guarantees another contract for CCOs unless the CCO, quote, and this is quoting, substantially fails to carry out the terms of the contract. Well, we wonder how substantially would be defined, and we question the need for this kind of statutory language in the process that would involve contract negotiations that OHA is responsible for. We've heard today the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations for the future of coordinated care, and encompassing 12 broad recommendations that identify for improvement of the function and accountability of CCOs. HCAO commends the Oregon Health Policy Board on their recommendations in the areas of transparency, accountability, health equity, social determinants, system integration, and sustainability. We've also heard mention of House Bill 2122, which also identifies and addresses specific areas for improving and reforming CCO transparency and accountability. And the HCAO Legislative Committee has provided testimony in favor of the goals of House Bill 2122. To the extent that OHA is able to negotiate with CCOs to bring about the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations in future contract years, our healthcare delivery system will benefit. It is essential that OHA have clear contract requirements to guide decisions about renewal of contracts. And somewhat ambiguous statutory language as written in Senate Bill 234 would serve to limit, in our opinion, would serve to limit Oregon Health Authority's ability to move forward with the progress that the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations seek to accomplish. I thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Dr. Thompson, it's lovely to see you.
Dr. Steiner Hayward, thank you.
Do you have any objections to the other, any concerns about 233 or just about 234?
So I haven't studied 233.
Okay.
It seems very interesting and raises some interesting questions. I think that listening to the testimony, having information is good. So that part, in my mind, sounds like it's the right thing to do.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I do have other comments around social determinants of health, which perhaps we can talk about some other time.
Be more than happy to. It'd be lovely to talk with you again.
Thank you so much.
Dr.
Thank
Thompson
you.
Was one of my senior residents when I was an intern, so we've known each other quite some time now.
I'm not going to read a testimony from OHA on 234. They say they are going to submit some revised testimony on 234. But I would like to close the public hearing on 234. I want to reopen the public hearing on 233 just because I just want to at least put on the record that OHA did submit testimony. And I'm just going to briefly, so that you can go on OLIS and check it out. There are Dash 2s, they say, they have concerns about. And regarding, and then they go into the definitions in Senate Bill 233. They say the globe, it will hurt rural Oregon. I won't go into why. It will limit flexibility to respond to federal changes. It will compromise actuarial soundness, which we had heard a lot about. It requires new global budget appeal provisions, which they feel would confuse the process. And I just wanted to put that on the record.
Madam Chair, the following should not be construed as my support or opposition to either of these two bills, but I'm a little concerned that Dr. Thompson's the only one who testified in opposition when I know...
To 234.
But to either... I mean, we didn't really hear a lot of testimony in opposition, any testimony in opposition to 233. And I appreciate the fact that OHA has submitted written testimony, but I guess... I get concerned when I have bills coming forward and nobody comes to testify in opposition and people just work behind the scenes. This is all entirely your discretion, of course, Madam Chair, but I would just put on the record that I get a little dismayed when we don't have the opportunity to ask opponents questions the same way that we do to ask proponents questions. And I don't believe that in this case silence equals assent. So... I'm just a little disconcerted because I know that there's some concerns about these bills. I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree with the concerns or the bills. I'm just saying that I think the purpose of these hearings is to hear both sides of issues or, you know, a wide range of things about issues and be able to address them in a public forum because that's the whole point.
I do have written that OHA is submitting written testimony only on the advice from the Department of Justice. There is a lawsuit, and that is why they, according to my understanding, why they aren't here. But
Madam Chair,
yes,
I don't think these have to do directly with the lawsuit, but maybe they would come testify if you schedule them for a work session. Right?
Absolutely.
Sometimes I get
well,
people moving.
No, I.
That would do it.
We'll see. We'll see. I do want to put this on the record, and I'm sorry. I'm going to. If you just hold tight here. I'm pulling up another email from Legislative Council, so just bear with me here. And it's not coming up very fast, but basically I did ask Legislative Council when there is a lawsuit against an agency on transparency and there are bills on rate review and there are bills on rate review, I asked how do we go about that? Are we going to be in conflict? And basically what Dexter Johnson from LC said, that rate review is prospective. There's no reason why we cannot hear, and I'm sorry I don't have his exact words, but I will send that to you and to the committee members on why he feels that there's no problem with going through these bills, even though there's a lawsuit, because each year it's prospective. So, yes.
You know, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm agreeing with my two colleagues. There's some issues there. There's some concerns about transparency, and that's always an issue that's troubling when you're talking about public agencies withholding information when we think that everything that we do, I mean, we've spent a lot of time in the legislature talking about the need to have open transparency, and when you start throwing around terms like proprietary information, and a sort of, from my perspective, government agencies don't have proprietary information. It's in the public interest to hear that. So I guess I'm, in fairness to them, it would be perhaps worthwhile to have the chair to invite them to come and talk to what they can, and they could certainly bring counsel with them if they felt the necessity and there's something outside of a court case. But.
Thank you. And I think Senator Cruz and I will be meeting on Friday, and we will take this under advisement.
Yeah, and if I could, Madam Chair, just, you know, we're on 233. That's what
yes,
you open. And
yes.
And it's just information. That's all it is. And it's not necessarily just for the public. You know, it's for the CCOs, too, and the fact that OHA continues to move the goalposts midstream, and just to have something solid, a basis for doing their work. So, you know, our governor has said she wants to be the most transparent governor in the history of the state. This is a step in that direction.
I did find... I did pull up the communication from Dexter Johnson, and he did say Senate Bill 233, and I'm sorry I don't have 234, and 234 are prospective and do not go into effect until January 1st, 2018. The lawsuit between Family Care and OHA concerns Family Care's current contract with OHA. OHA revises rates every year, so we don't think of these bills would affect what is at issue in the litigation. In other words, feel free to post these bills, work session, without concern over the court case. So that is for the record. All right? I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 233. And colleagues, we're done. We're adjourned.
Temporarily.
We're adjourned.